Farm, 4410 North Lincoln Avenue, Champaign. Producers of sustainably raised fruits and farmstead goat cheese. Prairie Fruits Farm is Illinois' first farmstead cheesemaking facility with fresh and aged goat cheeses, tree fruits, and berries. Open Saturdays from 9 to noon until the farmer's market season begins. 217-643-2314.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. And we're also pleased to have back here on the show after some time, Dennis Barron, who's professor of English here at the University of Illinois. From time to time, he's on this program, and we talk about language. And among the things he's interested in is the state of the language, its history, where it is headed. He also teaches courses in English grammar, so when he's here on the program, we give people the opportunity to ask grammar questions. Sometimes he's known as Dr. Grammar for that very reason. People stop him on the street and wherever they see him, and they say, you know, I have this question. And he's compelled to answer. He has been good enough to be with us before on the program and talk about language and invite whatever questions people have. And certainly grammar questions are welcome, too. If you have gripes, and often people do, about misuse, you may air them. And I guarantee you'll get probably almost no satisfaction.
No satisfaction whatsoever. Guaranteed.
No satisfaction guaranteed. But I guarantee you that we'll have a good time here before completely spontaneous and unrehearsed, like they used to say about
right.
The press.
Yeah, it's almost as if this were live radio.
Almost, but not quite. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
Oh, great to be here.
I was just thinking about the, I almost hesitate to get into the subject about the current controversy about immigration that we have.
Immigration. Going. Funny you should ask. Singing the national anthem
in Spanish. Very controversial now. Has something like this happened before? I know that there have been times before.
Well, it happened last week.
previous to last week, in the past, when it comes to immigrants, there has always been a lot of controversy about language.
Yes,
and speaking.
Definitely.
Speaking the language, and when do we expect people to have competency in English, and what are we going to do to deal with that in the meantime? And that is something that is nothing at all new about that.
Nothing new about that. It's been going on since before the United States was a United States. How to deal with multilingual situations, languages in contact and often in conflict. And what you see over the course of recorded history is that language issues are often stand-ins for other kinds of friction. And language is sort of an easy thing to pick on. It's very visible or very audible. And, speak the language or get out is another way of saying, even if you do change your language, we're still not going to like you very much.
You wrote
Wish
this.
You would go home.
Yeah, go back where you came from. You wrote a book about
this
particular issue of should English be made, and there have been attempts to have English made the official
language
of the United States.
That's right. And English is the official language of the state of Illinois. It is the official language of 27 states at the moment. The most recent states to make English official, I believe, were Iowa and West Virginia. Although maybe West Virginia didn't. I think the official language law was defeated in West Virginia. It was overturned on a technicality because it was added as a rider to a bill on another matter, and the West Virginia Constitution says a bill can only address one issue. And so even though the governor supported official English, I think he had to send it back. Interestingly, West Virginia and Iowa are the two states, according to the United States Census in 2000, that have the fewest number of non-English speaker residents in them. And you often see that the fear of the endangerment of the English language, as if English were an endangered species, surfaces in states that have really very, very little other language presence in them. And that leads you to think that it's kind of a symbolic issue rather than really a linguistic one.
We have some callers. Well, why don't we get on to them
momentarily? One comment about the Spanish translation of the national anthem.
Yes.
One of the interesting things about it, the networks were playing up President Bush, the soundbite where he was saying, "I think the national anthem ought to be sung in English, and everybody ought to speak English if they come here." And apparently the networks are now reporting that in Kevin Phillips' book about the presidency, Bush himself sang the national anthem in Spanish when he was on the campaign trail in 2000. And according to the CBS report I read this morning online, the White House can't remember whether that happened, which is, probably a code word for saying that it did happen, but they don't want to acknowledge it. Well, there are one final comment, and then we can go to the phones.
Yeah.
Several versions of the Spanish translation of the national anthem, the earliest being 1919, on the United States Department of State Spanish language website.
Indeed. Well, the thing that I was going to observe is I'm sure that President Bush, if he thought it was to his advantage, would demonstrate whatever competency in Spanish he
had. Exactly. I mean, that's what
politicians
do. If he was
in front of voters that spoke Spanish.
That's exactly what they do, and one of the reasons why it's been difficult to pass an English language amendment to the Constitution or the language of government law, which is the other version of the bills that have been in Congress in the last 20 years, almost every year, has been that legislators are reluctant to do this if they have a lot of immigrants in their districts. They're
going to
lose votes.
Voters,
it's a symbolic issue, yeah, but if it's going to cost them votes, then they pull back from doing anything really drastic about language issues.
Well, I'm certain someone has indeed done a study of this for people who come to the United States.
Yes,
who don't speak English or have little English. How long does it take people to acquire some kind of competency in English? And do most of them do that?
Most of them do it. The longer you're in the country, the more fluent you are in English. The pattern of losing your first language and replacing it with English happens almost universally by the third generation, so that people come here speaking a different language. They acquire some English, if not pretty good English fluency. Their children are typically bilingual, fluent in both languages, and the children of those children are typically monolingual English speakers, even if there is renewal of the immigrant community and a continued influx of speakers of that L1, as there has been from time to time. One of the issues, too, is that we experienced in the U.S. A pretty much cutoff of immigration between the early 1920s and 1965. Immigration bills in the early 20s essentially shut down immigration as a kind of reaction to World War I, kind of looking inward and xenophobia. And it wasn't until the Immigration Reform Act of 65 that it was really reopened. So we haven't had to deal with large groups of non-English speakers coming into the country for much of the 20th century. And that's why it's sort of a new issue. But the same thing's happening now that happened in between 1880 and 1917 in terms of language. The U.S. is known as the graveyard of foreign languages. The foreign language teachers have a joke. What do you call somebody who speaks more than one language? Bilingual. What do you call someone who speaks only one language? American.
Our guest is Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at University of Illinois, and occasionally is here. We talk about language, and questions are welcome. And we have several. So let us talk with people here, starting with someone on a cell phone, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have noticed a usage, and I haven't noticed it anywhere but central Illinois, although that may say more about my travel habits, and that is to, instead of saying, for example, the dog needs to be fed, it's
right.
saying the dog needs fed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been wondering if that is peculiar to central Illinois or if it's more widespread.
Okay, I've lived in central Illinois for 30 years, and while it is a peculiar place, that particular usage is not peculiar to central Illinois. It actually stretches from somewhere in Pennsylvania westward along a swath of territory that sort of tracks migration patterns in the 19th century from the East Coast through the Midwest. Often it's explained as coming from some kind of German influence from German speakers in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure if that's actually true. And I laughingly refer to it as the Pennsylvania passive or the Pittsburgh passive. The car needs washed.
Yes.
You're right. It is a localism as opposed to a sort of national
Seen it used in a newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you'll see it in writing as well as hear it in speech. So, and people who use it are completely unaware, typically, that people who don't use it find it strange.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
And people who don't use it find it strange that, how can you say that? It's so weird.
Yeah. This is something that now I've also lived here for almost 30 years, and I don't recall having heard that. It seems only within the last couple of years do I feel that
well,
I'm
people
hearing
who come
people
on this
say,
show don't say it.
Generally not. Generally
but
not.
But I bet a lot of the callers do.
Well, I will have
you
to start
listen.
Now. But keep,
yeah.
Listening.
You
be
listen
listening more carefully.
Yeah, because it is pretty you know pretty reasonably entrenched in the region.
Mm. Let's talk with another caller. This is Champagne and line two. Hello.
Yes, I have another grammar question that kind of drives me nuts. I hear it on the radio quite a bit. I might be wrong, but would the proper grammar be, say, John Doe pleaded guilty?
Pleaded versus pled.
Exactly. Help me with this one.
I've got no idea. They seem, I think, I would guess that I use them interchangeably.
The one it's my understanding that pled is the preferred, but to my ear, pleaded always sounds better. And,
yeah,
and I think I would have been more inclined to say pleaded, except that the convention in news stories seems to be pled.
I think so. And I think maybe more in legal terms, it's pled. But, you know, I pleaded with you to turn the music volume down. I can't stand it's keeping me up, you know. So in sort of conversational, non-legal, technical context, maybe we go with pleaded. And my guess is, too, that pleaded, the final ED suffix is the typical way that we make a past tense in English. It's the most common pattern. And so I think, you know, the legal usage may reflect the older plead, pled, pled, whereas the newer pleaded, I have pleaded my case, would just, you know, change that to the more common pattern. We do that a lot with verbs.
So both of them, you would say, are correct.
Right. You know, I mean, you get the same thing with hang and, you know, hanged and hung. You used to have the, you hang, what is it? Pictures are hanged and people are hung or something like that.
Right. Well, I guess.
But people use them interchangeably.
I'm going to have to struggle with this one, I guess. Further, I'm gonna just have to.
I feel which is the one you preferred? You preferred pled?
I prefer pled. Yeah, pleaded to me just sounds like a real mouthful.
Yeah,
pled is just I don't know. And I generally find it's on the radio that I hear pleaded.
Yeah, well, you know, people on the radio are careless, and you know they're out there to you know sell the product and the languages.
You
know,
all right. Well, thanks.
If we got paid for speaking English, maybe we'd pay more attention to it.
Let's go on here to line number. Well, see, that's it.
There you go.
Now, there is the answer to how it is you get your students
Sponsored by the English language.
You pay them.
You pay them.
You pay them to use correct grammar, and then you'd have something.
No, no, it doesn't work.
No?
It doesn't work.
You've tried?
The monetary incentive, uh-uh.
Oh. Oh, well.
Doesn't work.
Okay. Physical corporal
yeah.
punishment?
Well, have you tried that? People will say, okay, you know, every time you say a curse word, you got to put money in the can.
Yeah.
People still curse. Last time I heard.
Not on this radio station.
No.
No. We
no,
don't do
the
that.
Family station.
We couldn't handle the
family
fines.
Family station. This is not cable.
No. No, it's not. And that's not pay for listen. It's there. You turn it on, it's there. That's the problem.
That's the problem.
All right. Line three is champagne.
Children shouldn't be listening. They should be in school.
Absolutely right.
Hello?
Hello. Go ahead. Line
sorry
three.
About
yes,
that.
Go ahead.
I have two. The first was triggered by the first caller, whether something is local or not. About 80% of that's a rough figure, of what I hear on radio communications and cell phone people talking. They say, they'll ask, where are you at?
Yeah.
Rather than where are you? And I wondered if that was local in some way or...
No, not really.
Universal in the U.S.?
It's pretty common. There's a joke about it, but you can't say it on a radio station.
Okay. Yeah, the second one is something I've been, I don't know, looking at for years and wondering about. As it were, that expression I've seen written in the... Mm-hmm. Late 1800s, the first. It doesn't make any sense grammatically, to me. And furthermore, it never seems to add. You make a test every time you see it. Does this add anything to what the person's saying? In other words, is there any communicating value to this other than a pause?
So right. Okay. So
two aspects of as it were.
Give me an example.
Well. I'm talking to you. No, that wouldn't be good. A person might say, the price of corn is going up, and the economy is down, as it were, and then go on with...
Hmm.
It's very common. And
it seems to
reside among the more snooty of our...
Oh, yeah, it's a snooty. It's the needs-washed people don't say as it were. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, mutually exclusive kind of situation. As it were, I think typically, the nice thing about it, I suppose, is that it represents a survival of the subjunctive, which everybody always says is dying dead. Haven't heard a subjunctive in years and years. Would that it were true. As it were, typically, I think, refers to some condition contrary to fact. Or you're sort of conditioning what you're saying by saying something like, you know, I wish this was the case, but it isn't, or something like that.
Never got that.
It's a sort of, maybe, qualifier. This is sort of happening.
And how about using it with were? It were.
That's what makes it subjunctive. You can't say as it was.
But you could say it was.
You could say it was,
but it
wasn't. You see, if you're saying it was, but it wasn't, but you'd like it to be, then you say as it were.
Okay.
That doesn't make any sense, but it sounded good.
Okay.
You don't want to look too closely at what I say.
The tentative nature that somebody might be trying to...
Yeah, it's idiomatic.
See what happens.
It's idiomatic, and it is definitely snooty, as it were.
It's a fun program.
All right, thank you for the call. Our guest this morning in this hour, Focus 580, is Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at University of Illinois and is interested in the state of the language and language legislation attempts to enforce changes, which generally never work or almost never work.
I figured out how to do that, ending the sentence with where's it at, ending the sentence with a preposition joke without offending too many people. The freshman from down south comes to Harvard and is walking around Harvard Yard and sees somebody is looking for something, and he sees a professor type, and he says, excuse me, could you tell me where the where is the philosophy building at? And the snooty Harvard professor, as it were, says, here at Harvard, we don't end sentences with prepositions. And so the fresh young kid from Georgia says, all right, then, Where's the philosophy building at? Expletive deleted. There we go.
Okay. The questions are welcome here on the show.
Answers are usually not.
As long as we are in business. Answers, well.
Answers are a different thing.
That's a different thing. But questions.
Questions.
There are always questions.
Questions wanted. That could be the slogan. Questions wanted.
You should be in marketing.
I should be.
That's pretty good. Yeah, people think there are answers
here. I've been
trying
to sell language to people for 30 years, but they aren't buying.
You can't get them to buy it. You can't pay them to use it right. Had you ever thought of just maybe you if you had to do it over again, you'd be in some other business?
Hanging up my guns.
No, you're not
going to. Yeah, I would. I've often thought about what other careers could I have had? You know, I don't think I could make it in stand-up comedy.
It's a very rough business.
It's a rough business. But then there's journalism. I suppose that would be the other option.
Doesn't pay.
No, well.
And people are always, they're throwing stuff
they're
at you.
They're throwing stuff at you. It's like stand-up comedy.
Do they appreciate the efforts? No.
No.
All right.
No.
Let's see. Let's talk with someone in Belgium, not far away. Here, line number 4. Hello.
Okay. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. The word often.
Yes.
It kind of drives me up the wall when I hear someone say often.
Yes.
Because, okay, I'm 54 years old. I grew up around here.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 60s and 70s, when someone said often, with pronouncing the T, they were kind of considered uneducated. And now
really?
You hear mm-hmm. often all the time.
Often you hear often.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called a spelling pronunciation, if that helps any. There are a lot of words that we look at the spelling and alter a traditional pronunciation based on the way the word is spelled, because we think in our naive little minds that the spelling sets the rules for the language, when in fact it doesn't usually. But then, you know, it has that impact on us. One of the examples of that is how do you pronounce the name of the bird that is spelled Falcon, as in the title of the classic film noir, The Maltese blank.
Falcon.
Falcon, right. Everybody pronounces that L, okay? But the name of the author, who is known for writing, you know, long, long sentences.
Dashiell Hammett?
That's the guy who wrote The Maltese Falcon. But I'm thinking of William Faulkner.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Faulkner, the name Faulkner, we don't say Faulkner, we say Faulkner. That name preserves the original L-less pronunciation of the name of the bird, Falcon.
Oh, really?
See,
okay.
We've added the L back in the spelling somewhere around the 17th century or 18th century, and then the pronunciation followed the spelling. We do the same thing with the nut, the A-L-M-O-N-D, the almond. We pronounce the L in it very often.
Yeah,
anyway, this is a hypercorrection. Often is a hypercorrection, an overcorrection, a spelling pronunciation. I once went to a lecture, and the speaker was incredibly dull. And what I did, when you're in a kind of situation like that, you look for something else to do. So what I did was notice that every time he said that word, O-F-T-E-N, he pronounced the T. He said, often this and often that. And finally, he stopped speaking and got into a more relaxed mode for a question session. And whenever someone asked him a question, he said, often.
Really?
So
really?
Even the same speaker in a formal versus a relaxed context switched between the two forms.
Yeah. Because, okay, the word castle,
yes.
The word subtle, mm-hmm. S-U-B-T-L-E, mm-hmm. don't pronounce the I made a list 20 years ago of things like that.
Yeah, people keep these language scrapbooks.
That's the English language.
Yeah.
Okay, and I just wanted to say, huh. You were on this program a couple years ago.
Okay.
And someone called up, and you just said, huh.
Huh.
And Mr. Inge was laughing, and I was laughing, and Mr. Inge asked, huh, how do you spell that? And you said H-U-H, so.
Really? Okay. I don't remember that, but I'm sure I did it because I do things like that, and I plead guilty.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, now this leads to this question of, say, take this word often.
Yeah.
Why don't we just spell it O-F-F-E-N and
we
be
should.
Done with it?
We should.
Or,
you know,
or take the B out of subtle.
Why two Fs? Why not just one? O-F-E-N,
right.
Often.
Make it simplified and make it conform
and
to
course,
the pronunciation.
And, of course, you know, the issue in England is, as Gilbert and Sullivan parodied, when you say often, do you mean someone who has no parents or do you mean frequently?
I don't know. Why? Now, this is another one of these things that I know that you're interested in. Spelling reform.
Yeah.
And why? And because from time to time, people have
proposed
that. Oh, they said, yeah. Well, why? We have
Starting
these spellings
in the 13th
that don't
century, yeah.
make any sense.
Don't
relate
phonetic,
to the way we pronounce
English is hard to spell. How many people can spell well? Raise your hand. Very few people raise their hand.
So let's make it easy.
Let's make it easy.
This has never worked.
Never worked. Remember, the Chicago Tribune was a spelling reforming newspaper. They spelled though, T-H-O, for close to 100 years. And eventually in the mid-70s gave up because it wasn't catching on. We have no mechanism even if we could find a spelling reform system that would satisfy everybody, we have no mechanism for imposing it. Say, tomorrow everybody wake up and spell the new way. How are you going to enforce that? We can't even enforce, speed limits, drug laws, immigration laws. We can't do it. It's just, how are we going to say, okay, what's the fine for using the old form of spelling?
Let's get that B out of there, buddy. That's $50
right?
for that B in subtle.
People are still saying the mass in Latin someplace. It's hard to control other people's language.
All right. Dennis Barron is here. He is a professor of English at the University of Illinois. It's hard to control him, but we invite him here on the program every once in a while anyway.
Now I feel guilty.
No, yeah, please don't.
I will tone it down.
333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
Let's go to the phones.
Let's go to the phones. All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
It's me. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
I was wondering, Professor.
Or is it I?
Pardon?
Or is it I?
Where is what?
You said it's me, and I said, is it I?
You're right. I blew it already.
Everybody says it's me. You can't say, is it I? That sounds like, snooty.
It would sound snooty, right.
Yeah.
And boy, now I'm really embarrassed.
See?
Because I had a list of gripes. I was wondering if, Professor Barron, if you'd like to just...
I will comment.
I could just read off a few... words and terms that have taken over journalism. I hear it on television, and I run into. It seems that I'll run into a word. Don't get me started. Ran into a car. Okay, I ran into a word that I had never heard of used in that context. The word was vet.
Vet.
It was about politics or something, and it said, but that hasn't been vetted yet.
Yes.
Vetted.
Yeah, that's starting to make it out of the narrower context of government scrutiny over, is this okay or not.
But yeah. I didn't know. I looked it up in the dictionary. Mm-hmm. I thought a vet was either a veterinarian or a veteran of a war or something like that.
Yeah, but this is the vet as a verb, and it means to sort of decide whether or not something's kosher.
But what happens is I'll read it in one article, and then I'll read another article, and I'll find all of a sudden it's like the flu. It has spread everywhere.
Yes. Language is a virus.
A virus, right.
There's no inoculation.
How about inoculation against the word arguably?
Arguably.
I once read an editorial. I was going to read an editorial, and it finally, it happened. The first word of the editorial was
arguably, and you
didn't read it further.
Because
obviously, if you're a rhetorician is trying to persuade somebody, when you're writing an editorial, you give a little to the other side, so that you, so the person stays with you, and then you, of course,
then you hit them over the head, you know, when they're not looking.
You present your side.
Yeah.
When you say arguably, that's the most one of the most wishy-washy terms I've ever heard, because you're essentially tossing out your argument. You're saying, well, I'm going to make an argument, but you can argue it, so why bother reading it? Okay, I'm sorry, I'm on a roll now. See, you brought up journalism, and I am a journalism graduate from Carbondale.
Ah,
and it was interesting.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about hanged and hung.
Mm-hmm.
When I was young, I learned that a person was hanged.
Yes, and pictures were hung.
I also learned that if you didn't really care about something, you would say, I couldn't care less.
I could care less,
which is the totally the opposite.
Because people don't care about the distinction.
Okay, but why does it change? When does it change and why does it change?
When is more answerable than why? When is for could care less, you start seeing complaints about it, I would say, over the last 30, 40 years.
Okay.
And so that allows you to kind of guess about when it started to spread. Why it spread, I don't know. I mean, a lot of these things, we don't know why they happened, but they do happen. And that, and the interesting thing is sort of seeing why they, how they spread and what kinds of responses you get to them and why those responses are typically ignored. Because one of Barron's laws of English usage is by the time you hear somebody complaining about a language feature, it's already too late. It's so well established that there's nothing you can do about it. And Barron's second law is that somebody who complains about a language feature, if you listen to them or read them long enough, you'll see that they're making the same, they're uttering the same thing that they're complaining about. Because it's just so powerful, that force that we can't resist it.
Like me. Well, I guess that's arguable. But anyway, how about this
but
one?
But you see, arguably doesn't mean that something's arguable.
But it
arguably tends to be used, it seems to me, to say it's already been established. It's already been argued. We're going to accept that as a given and move on.
This
is arguably the best movie that's ever been made. Now I'm going to talk about something else.
But that means
it's already been established, at least by me. And if you've got something to say about it, too bad, Buster. I think that's the rhetorical move that people are. Maybe I'm wrong, but people tell me often often that I'm wrong.
Oh, yeah.
But it seems to me that's the typical rhetorical move that's being made when you say arguably.
Well,
it's arguably the best movie ever made.
But it's used. It was. I don't recall hearing it used so often as it is today.
Right. That's the other thing that happens. Something starts getting picked up in wider and wider contexts. People start noticing it. The more you use a form, the less it means. That's one of the basic tenets of information science.
I really apologize for griping like this.
That's okay. I'm they are rhetoricians, not rhetoricians, but we don't want to cut
I knew I had made a mistake.
But you see, people who complain always make their own mistakes,
I can't believe that.
That's the message to people who complain is, look to yourself, and why do you care so much about this stuff? Well, and, yeah, we all love and care about language, and that's why we call and talk about it, and I certainly do, and I teach about it in my classes. But, you know, the first thing that somebody, that I often say when somebody has a gripe is, okay, so why does that bother you so much?
Well, why does it bother me when I hear people say fewer than two and less than three?
Yeah, there was, I don't know if you, there used to be a Jewel on Green Street. Now it's just the Osco in
right.
town, and sort of in the heart of the university community. And I remember once going in there, and they, of course, like all good grocery stores, they have an express line. And don't get me started about why the express
okay.
lines are always slower than all the others. But there was a sign above it that said, you know, 10 items or less or something like that. And some academic clown obviously had climbed, and I'm an academic clown, so don't get me started on
okay.
that, climbed up on the conveyor belt and with a magic marker crossed off less and wrote in fewer.
Right. Well, that's something else. I wouldn't do that, but I'm going to complain about it. And did I really
yeah.
say rhetorician?
You said rhetorician, and, oh, you know, we've got it on tape.
I am so...
And it's, you know, you can check the WILL...
It'll be on the website.
...web archives and
yeah. right.
listen to your... Yeah, but we do that stuff all the time.
Well,
don't get upset about it.
No, it's the first time I've ever called in to a radio station or anything like this, so I'm a little nervous, but that's no excuse. But I just wanted your take on why certain terms are just we hear them over and over
right.
again, like, you know,
right.
ratcheted up, the run up to the war, the this, the that.
Yeah, people hear somebody else say it and it sort of catches on. It is viral in that sense. Sometimes
yeah.
it's a conscious imitation, but more often I think it's an unconscious imitation. We call this in linguistics accommodation. So when you're talking with somebody or reading something, you sort of adjust your language to match theirs.
Right.
And they do the same thing when they're listening to you or
yeah.
reading what you say. And what emerges is a kind of set of similarities. And that's how we influence one another. And that's how changes start spreading.
Right.
Because for some unknown reason, one particular change, somebody says it, you know, a lot of this stuff is sort of a random occurrence. It's like a genetic mutation. You know, it happens, and somehow it doesn't die. It catches on, and it's got some adaptive characteristics. We don't know
okay.
necessarily what they are, but people start using it, and it spreads and spreads. And sometimes it reaches a certain kind of saturation point, and then it goes away because you come up with something else instead to replace it.
Okay.
That's what happens with slang a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
But it happens with other language uses, too.
Yeah, I appreciate your correction. And it was nice talking with
well,
you.
Well, we appreciate your gripes, and they're always welcome, and I hope this is not going to be the last time you call.
Oh, no,
right.
not at all.
Yeah,
no,
all right, good. Yeah, this should be a pleasant experience.
No, it was.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the program. Dennis Barron is our guest. He's professor of English at University of Illinois.
So nobody wants to talk about Spanish national anthem. I'm surprised.
I guess not.
It's totally uncontroversial around here.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see. Let's go on to cell phone caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could discuss the role of some of the larger media in perpetuating some of these changes. I mean,
yes.
I've noticed, for example, that the word entitled seems not to exist anymore when you talk about the title of an article or a lecture, or even, I hate to mention this, but sometimes even David Inge will say, the only thing we ask of our colors is that they are, rather than be, brief. So I was wondering if you could comment on how the, because everyone is heard to a much greater extent when they're on the media,
yeah.
how that... that plays into this whole discussion.
It's an interesting question, and the answer, I think, is a mixed one, okay? Because the media has the kind of penetration into people's lives, particularly, you know, radio, TV, internet now as well. It gives the opportunity for new things or new variations to be outed very quickly, to spread and to be put on the table. Not all of them, though, catch on. And the interesting thing is to see what actually gets spread linguistically by the media and what doesn't. Because what we also notice, I mean, you'd think one of the arguments that was made 20 or 30 years ago was television is such a powerful medium that language will be impacted by it, and our language across the vast stretches of the United States will start converging, and we will see less and less variation, fewer and fewer variants. In fact, that doesn't seem to be happening in lots of situations. We are finding that variation is continuing by region, by urban versus rural, by social class distinction, and a lot of the traditional factors that sort of formed a gap between one group's language and another are still operating. And some dialectologists are claiming that, in fact, there's a fear of increased linguistic divergence rather than convergence, despite the sort of centripetal, center-seeking force of the media. It's not holding things together the way it had been predicted. Yeah, certain things catch on. Everybody knew very quickly that the word truthiness was the word of the year. Okay. But almost nobody says truthiness now. It has kind of subsided. Okay. So there's an impact of the media. Yeah, it was on everybody's lips for a few weeks, and they got tired of it.
I was also wondering if you find that it works more one way than the other, like to introduce changes rather than to correct them. I mean, you said, for example, that Chicago Tribune could not, for the life of them, get people to spell though in the way that they wanted. Mm-hmm. But a word like pleaded, which is correct, has been excised from a lot of text and replaced with pled, which is just like, you know, plead. Lead, it sounds like lead and lead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that, you know. Because the spelling reform of something like the Tribune was top-down, here's how we're going to do it, these are the rules, do it this way. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was a supporter of spelling reform. And I think it was in 1912. You can check that date. I don't remember. He issued a presidential proclamation, which doesn't really have the force of law, but is I think it was an executive order, not a proclamation, that required the government printing office to adopt 300 simplified spellings recommended by a group called the Simplified Spelling Board. And there was such violent opposition to this order that he quickly had to back down. He couldn't even get the government printing office, which he, I suppose, technically was in charge of, to do it his way. Because whereas an unconscious or less conscious sort of variant like pleaded pled gets spread not by edict, but by exposure. And people sort of pick it up informally that way. We have this thing, particularly in the United States, where, whenever I do this show, the phone lines light up almost instantly and they stay lit the whole hour. People want to know what's right. They always want to know what's right. And then if you tell them what's right, they say, you have no right to tell me how to speak because I'm an American. and we have free speech here, you know, and they just go to the, you know, it's going from the Fifth Amendment to the First Amendment. And so it's an interesting paradox that I see all the time. Tell me what's right. I tell them and they say, you're wrong. You can't tell me to do that. I resist. So that's what's going on. You know, changes happen naturally, but if you try to orchestrate a change, you get resistance.
All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, so it's like people standing in line at the bus stop. In England, they stand in line. In America, they stand in a clump.
The people, those of us in the chattering classes, spend a lot of time listening to each other, which would explain how it is.
This is what you call yourselves.
Exactly.
The chattering classes.
Oh, not me. Someone, I don't know.
This is the talk show
who term
lingo.
Who coined that term, but it's a pretty old one. Yes, indeed, mm-hmm. Yes. People who make blather for, like me, for blather for a living, such as it is. So that would explain how is it a term like vet gets around.
Yeah.
But does that really go beyond the chattering classes? I don't think that your average person on the street
is going to use a word like vet.
Well,
and the average person on the street, I suppose, doesn't have a context where the word a word like vet comes up.
I mean,
you know.
Probably not.
think about it. You know, what sorts of context would you, in a kind of, in your life, who do you vet?
Well, there must be in between my wife and I, there must be some vetting going on of ideas. Maybe things have to be vetted there.
All right, I want you to report back next time on the show. I want you to keep a log.
Vetting.
And see if you actually ever have a chance to use vet when you're not reading the news.
Taking the cat to the vet. That's something else entirely.
That's entirely something else. Let's vet the cat.
Let's vet the cat. He doesn't like that. They never do.
No, going in the car, getting in the box, they know what's coming.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk with someone in Robinson. No, pardon me, in Urbana. There, the next caller, line 3, Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
You said in England they stand in a line at bus. They stand in a queue.
Well, yes, I know that.
But I just had the point about the, as it were.
Yes.
I studied at Oxford in England, and I had asked my tutor there what that meant because I had heard people using it, and he says it doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a filler.
If you're American, you know. It's just a kind of interjection.
Yeah.
It's pointless and adds nothing. So.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd comment on that.
Okay, but, you know, these sorts of fillers, like you know and as it were, are not, I mean, we tend to dismiss them as, you know, meaningless, pointless. And we complain about people who say, you know, too much.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have a function. They have a linguistic function, and they are place fillers. So I remember, for example, in elementary school, the teacher sort of enforcing on us avoiding things like or. Okay, this was part of the curriculum in the New York City public schools. Don't let the kids say and or. And instead, we had to observe a moment of silence. As we gathered our thoughts and prepared. But what happens, and so, you know, I guess I sort of and remember consciously suppressing, you know, vocalizations because of that kind of training. But what happens in an actual conversation, which is when these things occur as opposed to in writing, if you observe a moment of silence as you try to phrase your next thought or cast about for the next thing that you're going to say, somebody jumps in, especially if, like me, you're from the East Coast. They don't patiently wait till you give some signal, like over to you, Chet. They jump in and you lose your speech turn. And so these things have the function of saying, I'm not done talking yet. You know, don't interrupt me.
Maybe.
Because I come from a speech community that's not as polite as people are around here.
Yeah, maybe. just one other comment.
Yes.
I just wonder what percentage of our native-born population can sing the Star Spangled Banner in its entirety in English.
Exactly. All 4 stanzas. I asked my students this, and one student said she had gone to a school where, for some reason, the music teacher really was into that song and made them all memorize all 4 stanzas. She couldn't remember them now. But typically, you go with the first stanza, and sometimes the fourth stanza is added in. Mm-hmm. It's musicians tell me that, singers tell me that it's a very difficult song to sing because of the range from high to low notes is beyond most people's capacity. My voice is so bad that I'm not even allowed to sing in the shower at home. So you couldn't tell by me if it was difficult or easy, if it were, but people report that. So, and the other thing that a lot of my students said when we discussed this issue, and they were all over the place on it. Some said, well, you know, they really liked the Spanish translation was a lot less militaristic, and a lot of them liked the tune, that sort of the beat was kind of nice as opposed to the more military march style. And others said, you know, it's a sacred institution, and you can't change the language on it. It happened to be on the Smithsonian Institution website, and they have a version of the music of the Star-Spangled Banner played on 18th century instruments. And it's so I played that. It's a sound file. I recommend that you go check it out. It's actually very interesting sound because it sounds like Mozart meets Sousa. It's much different from the way we hear it today. So there's that. I mean, it's always controversial when Jimi Hendrix did his version of the Star-Spangled Banner. It was very controversial. And Marvin Gaye's and Jose Feliciano's was controversial, too. I remember when he came out with that. So people get exercised over this stuff.
Great.
Thank you for the call. I'm sorry to say, we'll have to stop. We have used the time. We have some other callers we can't take.
I noticed you didn't say we used it wisely.
We just used it. I'm not going to make any
comments. As the car guy said, you've wasted another hour.
Another perfectly good hour. That's right. With me and Dennis. But perhaps in the summer you'll come back.
Oh, yes.
We will do it again.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you for being
here. Thank
you. It's good to see you, as it were, often on the show. So thank you for being here. Dennis Behrens, professor of English here at the University of Illinois. Occasionally he's on the show. We talk about language. Support for the program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. In the next hour of this program, we will be talking about the first and only man ever to be hung as a slave trader here in the United States. His name was Gordon, and this happened in 1862. We'll be talking about the story as we talk with Ron Sudalter. He's an educator and historian.